this outfit. You're a low-down greaser hiring rustler. You hire poor ignorant vaqueros and kill them to get out of paying their wages. I rode for you. I learned your braceta tricks. I know you stole most of Colonel Lambert's stock and tried to steal his daughter. I chased your new outfit across the river just a day or so ago, brand burning my stock. Watson caught you and got away, only to be shot by your pard Breen Sawtell, and before I killed Sawtell, I got your case from him. Pecos spat as if to rid himself of the bitter restraint he must hold this day. And now, you yellow-faced greaser dog, get out. Get across the river. Hide in the brakes, because if I ever lay eyes on you again, I'll kill you. Amid a stunned silence, the half-breed lunged around, head down like a blinded bull, and spreading the crowd, he disappeared. Pecos stood motionless a moment, until suddenly he relaxed. He flipped his gun. It turned over in the air to alight in his palm. Sheathing it, he turned to face the fuming judge. "Not on our marriage program, Judge," he said, with the old drawl edging into the ring of his voice. "Hell no, not on my court proceedings at all. Pecos Smith, whoever you are, you have a high-handed way." "Yes, and you better savvy this," retorted Pecos. "I've done your little community a good turn. That man has been the bane of Eagle's Nest. You heard why I couldn't kill him." "Smith, I'm not raring about your driving Felipe off, but it'd have been a better job if you'd bored him instead of shooting fancy didos around him." "Uh-huh. Well, what's eating you, then?" "It's again the law, shooting here. Contempt of court, and I'm compelled to fine you, sir." "What?" ejaculated Pecos, completely floored. Terrell came hurriedly from the door to catch his arm and press it. "Oh, Pecos," was all she could falter. "I said contempt of court," repeated the judge, imperturbably. "I'm compelled to fine you." "Leaping bullfrogs. How much, Judge Roy Bean, law west of the Pecos, justice of the peace, saloon keeper, bartender, and parson, and God only knows what else? How much?" "I was about to say $50, but it's $75. "What would it cost me if I'd plugged the breed?" inquired Pecos sarcastically. "I reckon my law on the case now reads $100. "You got Don Felipe skinned to death," yelled Pecos. "Upon reflection, the fine imposed for more contempt of court will be $125, not pesos." "Robber, road agent, $150, shouted Judge Bean, purple in the face. Terrell gave Pecos a wrench that fetched his face round to hers. "Pay him before he ruins us," cried Terrell, and Pecos did not know whether she was bursting with mirth or alarm or both. "Hello, honey. Doggone, I forgot about you." "Sure, I'll pay it," he declared, whipping out the roll with magnificent gesture and peeling off bills galore. "Reckon I'm never going to be married again. Here, Judge, buy yourself some Lobex and paint another big signboard in big letters. Shout out, stranger, or you can't get west of the Pecos." End of book. West of the Pecos by Zane Gray. This book is produced for special distribution as authorized by Act of Congress under Public Law 89-522.
That's all the time we have. Thank you for joining us for the Noon Book Hour. We hope you'll join us again tomorrow for our next installment from the Recording Library of West Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Entertainment Weekly, followed by USA Today at 2.
Now here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 51 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, cloudy with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the upper 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 1 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Entertainment Weekly Magazine. I'm volunteer reader Diane Salisbury for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I am reading from Entertainment Weekly's website, EW.com. The Oscars were nominated, or at least the nominations were nominated, just last week as I'm recording this, and I am going to start with those Oscar nominations, and then we'll get into the article about what we should be watching this week. And there are quite a few movie and TV reviews that are on the website that are new this week. I don't even think I'm going to get to all of them. So we have a full show with lots to hear about. And let's get to these Oscar nominations first. 2023 Oscar nominations announced. See the complete list of nominees for the 2023 Oscars as announced by Allison Williams and Riz Ahmed. This is by Joey Nolfi. Months of film festivals, red carpets, and predictions have all led to the moment the Academy unveiled the nominations for the 2023 Oscars on Tuesday morning. Announced by actors Allison Williams from Megan and Riz Ahmed from Sound of Metal, ABC's televised rollout turned high-profile contenders into Oscar nominees, following a contentious race that included everything from prestige gems like Everything Everywhere All at Once, Tar, and The Fabelmans, and major blockbusters like Top Gun Maverick, Avatar The Way of Water, to late-breaking international dramas like All Quiet on the Western Front. As expected, A24's multiverse epic Everything Everywhere All at Once led the nominations list with 11 overall appearances in key categories, including Best Picture, Best Actress for Michelle Yeoh, Best Supporting Actor for Ki Huy Quan, and Best Supporting Actress for both Jamie Lee Curtis and Stephanie Hsu. Trailing just behind are the German war epic All Quiet on the Western Front and Martin McDowell's The Banshees of Inisherin, both of which scored 9 nominations, including 4 acting nominations for the latter's cast members, Colin Farrell, Brendan Gleeson, Barry Keoghan, and Kerry Condon. Blockbuster titles also hit big with the Academy, including Avatar The Way of Water and Top Gun Maverick in Best Picture, which means Tom Cruise earned a nod as a producer of the Top Gun sequel despite missing out on a Best Actor nomination. Angela Bassett, the Best Supporting Actress frontrunner, also became the first ever performer from a Marvel movie to bag an Oscar nomination for her work in Black Panther: Wakanda Forever. Surprise omissions from the list include Eddie Redmayne and Paul Dano in The Good Nurse and The Fabelmans, Viola Davis in The Woman King, and Danielle Deadwyler in Till, while performers like Judd Hirsch, also in The Fabelmans, and Andrea Riseborough in To Leslie seemingly swooped into their respective categories at the last minute with little precursor support. The network will again broadcast the upcoming Oscars with Jimmy Kimmel returning to host after previously serving as MC for the 2017 and 2018 ceremonies, with Glenn Weiss and Ricky Kirshner producing the ceremony. All I will say is that we're moving forward. It's going to be a return to a show that's about a love of cinema, international cinema, diverse artists. And it's our 95th Oscars, so there are going to be some great legacy surprises, Academy CEO Bill Kramer teased in September of the upcoming show. The 95th Academy Awards will air Sunday, March 12th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time and 5 p.m. Pacific Time on ABC. Before then, here's the full list of 2023 Oscar nominations. And I'm not going to read the full list because we have limited time on this show, but I am going to hit a lot of the major ones. So for Best Picture, All Quiet on the Western Front, Avatar, The Way of Water, The Banshees of Inisherin, Elvis, Everything Everywhere All at Once, The Fabelmans, Tar, Top Gun Maverick, Triangle of Sadness, and Women Talking. For Best Director, it's Martin McDonagh for Banshees of Inisherin, Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert for Everything Everywhere All at Once, Steven Spielberg for The Fabelmans, Todd Field for Tar, and Ruben Östlund for Triangle of Sadness. Best Actor, we have Austin Butler for Elvis, Colin Farrell for The Banshees of Inisherin, Brendan Fraser for The Whale, Paul Mescal for After Sun, and Bill Nighy for Living. In the Best Actress category, it's Cate Blanchett for Tar, Ana de Armas for Blonde, Andrea Riseborough for To Leslie, Michelle Williams in The Fabelmans, and Michelle Yeoh for Everything Everywhere All at Once. In the Best Supporting Actor category, it's Brendan Gleeson for Banshees of Inisherin, Brian Tyree Henry in Causeway, Judd Hirsch in The Fabelmans, Barry Keoghan in Banshees of Inisherin, and Ki Huy Quan for Everything Everywhere All at Once. And in Best Supporting Actress, it's Angela Bassett in Black Panther: Wakanda Forever, Hong Chow in The Whale, Carrie Condon in The Banshees of Inisherin, Janie Lee Curtis for Everything Everywhere All at Once, and also Stephanie Sue for Everything Everywhere All at Once. For Best Screenplay, the movies are All Quiet on the Western Front, Glass Onion, A Knives Out Mystery, Living, Top Gun Maverick, and Women Talking. That list was for adapted screenplay, and for original screenplay, the movies are The Banshees of Inisherin, Everything Everywhere All at Once, The Fabelmans, Tar, and Triangle of Sadness. For Best Animated Feature Film, it's Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, The Sea Beast, and Turning Red. For Best International Film, All Quiet on the Western Front, Argentina 1985, Close, E.O., and The Quiet Girl. The Best Documentary Feature is All That Breathes, All the Beauty and the Bloodshed, Fire of Love, A House Made of Splinters, and Melvaney. For the short films, it's the best animated short film is The Boy, The Mole, The Fox, and The Horse, The Flying Sailor, Ice Merchants, My Year of Dicks, and An Ostrich Told Me the World is Fake, and I Think I Believe It. For best live-action short film, the movies are An Irish Goodbye, Evalu, Le Pupil, Night Ride, and The Red Suitcase. And the best documentary short has The Elephant Whisperers, Haul Out, How Do You Measure a Year, The Martha Mitchell Effect, and Stranger at the Gate. So that was an abbreviated list, but got to the big categories and some of the ones that you need to know about in case you want to check them out before March. Next, I'm going to our article on what to watch. Jennifer Lopez should have held out for more than Shotgun Wedding. Poker Face is the crime show reborn. What's worth your time in movies and TV this weekend? Entertainment Weekly's critics review the latest releases, Shotgun Wedding, Infinity Pool, You People, Shrinking, and Poker Face. This is by Leah Greenblatt, Joshua Rothkopf, Kristen Baldwin, and Darren French. Shotgun Wedding is on Prime Video now. Has anyone said I do on screen with more yes to the dress commitment than Jennifer Lopez? Between The Wedding Planner, Monster-in-Law, Marry Me, and now Shotgun Wedding, she's given us an entire frothy over. The honeymoon ends fast, alas, in her latest union as slapdash action comedy, too silly and frantic to really be fun. Lopez stars as Darcy, a woman with no discernible backstory, and a fiancé, played by Josh Duhamel, named Tom, a minor league baseball player who's cost-conscious enough to insist on a do-it-yourself destination wedding in the Philippines. It's cheaper than Bali. Things are already tense with her loopy future mother-in-law, played by Jennifer Coolidge, and the chesty ex, played by Lenny Kravitz, that her wealthy father, played by Cheech Marin, has invited without her consent. And then the couple's bargain location bites back. Pirates bum-rush the resort, taking everyone in the wedding party hostage, except the bride and groom, who've been too busy bickering pre-ceremony to get caught up in the sweep. Hijinks and shenanigans ensue, most of which director Jason Moore from Pitch Perfect plays for chaotic featherweight camp. Whoopsies, we just blew up another terrorist! The movie doesn't ask Lopez and Duhamel to do much more than stay sentient and golden-skinned while they run and flail, though Coolidge can still do Daffy deadpan in her sleep. A flamboyantly shirtless Kravitz, bless him, has more sharp angles on his clavicles than in his line delivery. This wedding clearly wasn't meant to be a masterpiece, but even as midwinter fluff, it feels like a rush job, a marriage made for lazy Sunday streaming at best, till death, or more likely, a better script, do you part? Leah Greenblatt, writes Shotgun Wedding a C-. Infinity Pool is in theaters now. Wealthy white people getting ugly on vacation. They're having a bit of a moment with White Lotus and Triangle of Sadness. Toxic entitlement greasing the wheels that, if stuck, would trigger harsher consequences. When these scenarios turn cautionary, as with the thrilling third world revenge fantasy Bacurau, they play like valuable dispatches from the front lines of today's social warfare. But as it turns out with director Brandon Cronenberg's slick, strenuously naughty Infinity Pool, letting the characters descend into a moral freefall without any real downside gets tiresome fast. Don't blame his Game for Anything cast. Alexander Skarsgård, still ripped from The Northman, plays James, a blocked novelist with one flop to his name who, regardless of his dim prospects, finds himself at a swanky resort in a vaguely Adriatic country thanks to his wife, Em, played by Cleopatra Coleman, daughter of his wealthy publisher. Already, you sense the balance of marital power is skewed, so the idea of sneaking off the heavily guarded compound with another couple becomes appealing. Until James accidentally mows down a farmer in the middle of the night with a convertible. The penalty for such infractions in fictional Lee Tolkwa is death, but there's good news. This fascist country with communist-era decor also seems to have mastered the science of instant cloning, and, for a fee, there's a convenient ATM in the brutalist-designed jail. You can, quote-unquote, double yourself and watch your own execution from the sidelines. Yes, we're in Cronenberg country, where goo, gore, and bodily rebirth are religions. Let's be kind. Before Brandon's famous dad, David, matured into the maker of Dead Ringers and Crash, the good one, he was a purveyor of sophomoric Fall of Civilization flicks just like Infinity Pool. At least Mia Goth, herself recently reborn as indie horror's new scream queen with Pearl, understands the assignment, getting more unhinged with every scene. Her character starts off with vigorous flirting and a brusque hand job and goes from there. Even as the escapades become more violent, and why not, with a cloned surrogate to take the fall, they somehow feel less meaningful with every brandished genital and suckled breast. But what of James's soul? Cronenberg wants us to worry about that. But you never think this guy's next book is going to be any better. Joshua Rothkopf is rating Infinity Pool a B-. You People is on Netflix now. A millennial meet the parents with a heavy side of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, or at least a spectacularly awkward lunch at Roscoe's. You People feels like a lab experiment designed for Netflix. Big stars, broad comedy, a sitcom brightness to every scene. It's also strenuously topical and not a little bit outrageous about race. A tale of two lovers recast for a hyper self-aware 2023 by Blackish creator Kenya Barris, making his feature directing debut. Jonah Hill, who co-wrote the script with Barris, plays it relatively close to home as Ezra Cohen, a Jewish finance guy from West LA whose true passion is the cross-cultural podcast he hosts with his best friend, a black lesbian named Mo, played by comedian Sam Jay. Even Mo thinks Ezra's dating situation is desperate, but when he meets Amir Mohammed from the game's Lauren London, the search is over. It's real love. All he has to do is convince Amira's parents, Akbar and Fatima, played by Eddie Murphy and Nia Long, that he can make their daughter happy. But it's clear from Akbar's Fred Hampton was murdered hoodie and his cold stare that Ezra is not the suitor this particular dad, he used to be Woody before he committed to Islam, is looking for. Barris has too much collective comedic talent on screen between Hill, Murphy, and Julia Louis-Dreyfus as Ezra's wildly overcompensating mom not to land a few genuinely great lines, and he gives his upscale Los Angeles setting a sunny Nancy Myers gloss. But his insistence on maximum discomfort comedy in nearly every scene seems like a test of how much your sphincter can contract in secondhand embarrassment. My kingdom for no more fun facts about Exhibit from David Duchovny. The movie is much better when it relaxes its death grip on screenwritery, punchlines, and slapstick cringe, and just allows its cavalcade of stars to act like actual, you know, people. Leah Greenblatt is rating You People a B-. Shrinking is streaming now on Apple TV+, and there's a short review here, but I'm going to read the longer one that's in the TV section. Shrinking Review, a feel-good comedy about grief. Jason Segel and Harrison Ford star in the Apple TV Plus series about a widowed therapist from the producers of Ted Lasso. This is by Kristen Baldwin. A good laugh or a good cry, not every show makes you choose. After driving millions of viewers into laughter through tears territory with Ted Lasso, executive producer Bill Lawrence and star writer and co-executive producer Brett Goldstein deliver more emotion-soaked humor with the Apple TV Plus series Shrinking, a funny, brainy grief-com about the power and dangers of radical honesty. Jimmy, played by Jason Segel, is a mess and has been since his wife Tia, played by Lillian Bowden, died unexpectedly a year ago. He spends his nights sublimating the pain with booze and pills, leaving his also grieving teen daughter Alice, played by Lukita Maxwell, to be parented by his blunt next-door neighbor Liz, played by Krista Miller. During the day, a fried and hungover Jimmy heads to work at the Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Center, where he struggles to stay engaged as his regular patients recite their regular complaints. Exhausted and pushed to the limits of decorum by a woman, played by Saturday Night Live's Heidi Gardner, who's forever making excuses for her emotionally abusive husband, Jimmy erupts, "Just effing leave him!" To his surprise, it works. Despite warnings from his methodical boss Paul, played by Harrison Ford, and newly divorced colleague Gabby, played by Jessica Williams, Jimmy decides to continue his psychological vigilante approach with his newest patient, Sean, played by Luke Timmy, a military vet who keeps getting into violent altercations with strangers. Jimmy and Sean's two broken people helping each other heal arc serves as Shrinking's narrative centerpiece, but the show connects a variety of characters in nimble ways. After determining to clean up his act, Jimmy reconnects with his best friend Brian, played by Michael Urie, reliably hilarious, a lawyer who we later learn has been trying to help Paul with his estate planning for years. But Paul has yet to tell his estranged daughter Meg, played by Lily Rabb, the truth about his ailing health. Instead, he's trying to keep Jimmy from ruining his relationship with Alice by counseling her on the sly. Alice, meanwhile, bonds with Sean over their similar reservoirs of tamped-down despair. As she navigates the single life again, Gabby finds a sympathetic ear in Liz, whom she previously wrote off as such a mom. Segel, who created Shrinking with Lawrence and Goldstein, has crafted the perfect character for his comedic strengths. Jimmy is almost pathologically flustered, alternating between overbearing enthusiasm and awkward under-the-breath asides. I see what I'm doing with my body. I'll stop. It's weird. Segel excels at fidgety physical comedy, and the actor engenders a self-aware sweetness throughout Jimmy's rocky path to healing. Harrison is an absolute freaking delight as Phil. The 80-year-old icon seems to revel in his curmudgeon phase of his career, and it's never not funny to hear the actor grumble lines like, "Why do you have so many scrunchies on your lamp?" in his gruff and gravelly baritone. The aforementioned scrunchies belong to Gabby, played with vivacious confidence by Williams. Though there are some similarities to Ted Lasso, the effusive and unorthodox protagonist, the compassion-centered comedy and heart-swelling moments of melancholy, Shrinking establishes itself as a distinct entity. The show generates the most joy when it lets the extraordinary ensemble pair up in new combinations, Yuri bouncing his spirited quip machine energy off Harrison's brusque disdain, Williams and Miller developing Gabby and Liz's relationship from confrontational clapbacks to conspiratorial pals. And we haven't even gotten to Ted McGinley, exuding carefree charm as Liz's put-upon but perpetually pleasant husband, or all-star guests like Neil Flynn and Wendy Malick. Like Lasso, Shrinking sometimes heightens the drama unnecessarily in an effort to force the emotional climax, and two characters enter into an ill-conceived romantic entanglement during the second half of the 10-episode season. But this is a promising and unique venture, blending highbrow, shout out to Carl Jung, and lowbrow, projectile vomit humor. The sharp writing offers poignant feels, and the cast seems up for anything. Trust me, watching Harrison Ford sing his heart out to Sugar Ray is therapeutic. Christian Baldwin is rating Shrinking a B+. Next, we have Poker Face, and again, I have a longer review. It says that Poker Face, there's 4 episodes streaming now on Peacock, and new episodes are streaming on Thursdays. So here's the longer review by Darren French. Natasha Lyonne stars in the sensational mystery from Rian Johnson. Natasha Lyonne comes off like the last pack of cigarettes in a world of vape pens. She leads Peacock's snazzy new series, Poker Face, as Charlie Kale, a casino waitress who drinks on the job and before the job. It's charming because it's Lyonne. Ashy voice, molten hair, general affect of a kid who wants to be a crazy old coot. Charlie's going nowhere, so slow her car won't start. Then the weekly mystery, debuting Thursday, sends her everywhere fast. She becomes an amateur detective solving perfect murders across a nation of guest stars. Poker Face rehumanizes and re-weirds TV crime, carving a third way between network franchises and prestige gloom. The premiere begins in Frost Casino, when Natalie, played by Dasha Polanco, sees something illegal in a VIP's room. The maid tells her boss, who wears a horseshoe pinky ring, whose private elevator has a private bar, who is a villainishy named Sterling Frost Jr., and who is played with doe-eyed sleaze by Adrian Brody. Things go wrong for Natalie in a fatal cover-up perpetrated by Sterling's enforcer Cliff, played by Benjamin Bratt. Act 2 circles back in time to introduce Charlie as Natalie's friend, Sterling's employee, and a human lie detector. She knows when you bluff about cards or corpses. Charlie wants to find out who offed Natalie. Her investigation goes so well that by episode 2, she's on the run, off the grid, and bleeding. Powerful bads hunt her. The right move is to stay lost forever. Then someone else gets dead outside a New Mexico truck stop where Charlie just had the best Subway sandwich of her life. The trend continues wherever she parks. At a barbecue joint, at a retirement home, in a heavy metal dive bar, at a dinner theater. Each story circles a helix, a killing, the hours or days before, the search for truth after. That's a familiar jagged chronology from creator Rian Johnson, who loops his Knives Out movies around flashbacks and also made like Looper. Johnson is suddenly mysteries historian populist, refurbishing drawing rooms for the Elon age and giving Jessica Fletcher her final IMDb credit. He writes and directs Poker Face's pilot, which glories in a few influences, revealing whodunit before the sleuth even sleuths come from Columbo. the legendary cop drama that also inspires the ostentatious yellow credits and Charlie's scruffy slyness. Peter Falk was a Los Angeles cop, so Leone's nomadic freelancing suggests other myths. I think in another life you were like a knight, Natalie tells her Lady Galahad. They're watching Samuel L. Jackson in Pulp Fiction deciding to walk the earth like Kane in Kung Fu. Charlie embodies that wandering heroism. And did I mention Cliff calls Charlie a regular little Michael Weston? Any procedural elitist will praise Columbo guilty. What I didn't expect from the homage factory was sincere reverence for Burn Notice. Those shows don't remotely exist now. Private Eyes faded. USA ditched Blue Skies. Weekly Investigations got co-opted by Naval Law, Science Cops, and Dick Wolf's ever-expanding empire. Eccentricity survived only under official oversight as various consultants partnered with PDs or feds in The Mentalist, Bones, Castle, and The Blacklist. Premium cable and streamers prefer long form, but most seasonal mysteries are just short stories made endless. They share a grim tone of self-righteous navel-gazing. Serialization used to imply ambition, now it's lame enough for criminal minds. Any exception proves the rule, which is why Sumptown died fast, and there were maybe 5 good Sherlocks. There's a lost mood, hippie or noir, where no budget free spirit proves brain cells are the most powerful weapons. The last uncanny Private Eye drama was 2010's Blissful Terriers. Creator Ted Griffin rediscovered the genre's class-conscious fire, pairing low-credit score gumshoes against capitalists, paving paradise to put up an airport. That echoes Columbo, the shaggy cop in a pigpen convertible outwitting SoCal's manor class. Would you believe Griffin appears in Poker Face's pilot? Nice hat tip from Johnson, who directed a Terriers episode written by Leslie Headland, who co-created Russian Doll with Natasha Lyonne. Loop closed. Johnson directs the first 2 episodes of the 10-part season and will direct another one. Of the 6 episodes released to critics, my favorites come later, when showrunners Nora and Lila Zuckerman start riffing. Mulray Horry goes big as a barbecue baron. Chloe Sevigny exudes blasé swagger as a rock singer. Hung Chow is a trucker. It's awesome. This is utmost Adrian Brody, sweet yet oily. Any scene with S. Epatham Merkson and Judith Light together is the best scene. A looming threat chases Charlie, though for now individual stories are siloed. No homicide ensemble operates the same. Deaths are impulses or heists. Many killers are financially desperate, and one sneaky point is how their private anguishes wind up looking selfish, even ridiculous. Leone gets Fox's trick of letting guests peacock while she leisurely burrows. It's a thrill to watch Charlie think over clues. Savviness doesn't make her cynical. Leone can exude low-key sadness or genuine shock. Her response to sudden violence is a funny marvel of real person horror. Oh, F! At first I was worried Charlie was too much an actor-producer's vision board, the fugitive's big long goodbye to Rockbowski files. Her car, which does finally start, is a blue 1969 Barracuda. The show's one wrong note, very cool retro when a junky sedan would do. A human polygraph was ridiculous enough for Fox in 2009. Lie to me, fun. It's marvelous here because Charlie's gift layers tension under every conversation. You feel how much she enjoys truth and how disappointed lies make her. Charlie always works whatever gig requires the least ID, so the flashbacks are also social expansions, revealing criminals and victims from an entry-level perspective. For all Poker Face's pop history, you could define it by absences. Here's a detective with no home, no gun, no phone, no supporting cast, a past to escape, and a doomed future. Hell of a hand, I'm all in. Darren French is rating Poker Face an A. And those are all the shows in our What to Watch article. That was Jennifer Lopez should have held out for more than Shotgun Wedding. Poker Face is the crime show reborn. Before I get to some of these movie reviews, I'll remind everyone that you are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Entertainment Weekly Magazine, and I am reading from their website, EW.com. Next, I have a movie review for Magazine Dreams. Jonathan Majors goes beyond reason in a fraught bodybuilder drama. The Lovecraft Country star is unmissable in Elijah Bynum's surreal, explosive character study. This is by Leah Greenblatt. There are certain films that seem to ask for more than performance, a whole embodiment of psyche and soul that only a vaunted handful of actors, like Denzel Washington, Daniel Day-Lewis, and Christian Bale, become known for. That kind of Taxi Driver, I drink your milkshake intensity is all over Magazine Dreams, which premiered last night at the Sundance Festival. And while it may not technically make Jonathan Majors a star, his upcoming commitments to Marvel seem much more likely to get that business done, it is hard not to feel physically altered just by watching him on screen in writer-director Elijah Bynum's astonishing and often excruciating drama. Majors disappears entirely inside Killian Maddox, an aspiring bodybuilder who lives in a shabby bungalow in Los Angeles with his ailing grandfather, played by Harrison Page. Killian's body is a temple, an ode to rippling symmetry that he feeds with endless plates of protein and punishing workouts. But his mind is a swarm of bees. He can't seem to figure out how to read social cues or say the ordinary things that put people at ease, and violent outbursts overtake him suddenly like electric storms. The steroids he injects daily probably don't help, but it's more than that. Confusion and grievance are his daily burden, and he will not be ignored. Not by the painting service that does a careless job on his grandpa's house, or the bronzed fitness god, played by Mike O'Hearn, who won't respond to his fan mail. He faithfully enters every competition he can, and he can't understand why he hasn't yet become the kind of cover star champion that papers his walls and consumes his thoughts. Except that the only reason must be he's not pushing hard enough, not unless it hurts. But he's also not wrong about a lot of what he sees in the world. The institutional indifference and inequalities that should make any sane person paying attention furious. Sometimes he says these things to his court-ordered therapist, played by Harriet Sampson Harris, with startling lucidity. Other times he seems to be living entirely in his own fantasies. And that is a burden he can't share as much as he tries. When he finally finds the courage to ask out his crush, played by Cyrano's Haley Bennett, at the grocery store he works at 3 days a week, their date is tender and sweet, and then abruptly a disaster. All the things that might keep Killian anchored, recognition, a small kindness, connection, can't stop going the wrong way, and as he continues to tumble down rabbit holes, Magazine becomes a sort of spiraling fever dream, an endurance test. Bynum, from Hot Summer Nights, swinging between stark verite and the more surreal corners of Killian's own increasing untethered mind, begins to make it clear where all this might be going. We know what lonely, disgruntled, and mentally unwell men are capable of, or more accurately, we are terrified because we know we can't ever really know. That makes the last 40 minutes feel singularly, almost unbearably fraught to sit through, a string of harrowing scenes that vibrate with the possibility of both redemption and explosive violence. Again and again, Bynum's spare, crackling script confounds whatever expectations his audience might have of what comes next, though he also gives the movie at least four endings, several of which would probably have served it very well. But even as the pacing falters, Majors is impossible to look away from, a man who desperately needs the world to see him, and if they refuse, to feel his pain. Leah Greenblatt is rating magazine Dreams an A-. Close review, When Boys Grow Apart. Belgium's nominee for this year's Best International Feature Oscar offers a gorgeously devastating portrait of adolescence. This is also by Leah Greenblatt. One of the enduring mysteries of movies is how difficult it seems to depict childhood on screen with any real depth or feeling. There's something evanescent, maybe, about the act of even trying, so instead we get archetypes, adorable moppets, juvenile delinquents, precocious eye-rolling tweens. That's what makes a drama like Lucas Dans Close, now Belgium's newly minted Oscar nominee for Best International Feature, feel both rare and precious, a film that captures the hothouse intimacy of adolescent friendship with such exquisite insight and specificity that it often feels less like a movie than a memory palace. Which is not to say there isn't a relatively straightforward narrative. Leo, played by Eden Dambreen, and Remy, played by Gustave de Valle, are two ordinary, if exceptionally lovely, 13-year-old boys living somewhere in the Flemish countryside, still suspended in the magic hour between tender youth and teendom. Their respective parents are happy to watch them tumble like puppies between their two nearby houses, playing and roughhousing and doing the rowdy, impenetrable things kids do. The boys are inseparable and unself-consciously physical with one another, sleeping curled together in a single bed like koala bears, sprawled out lazily in the grass with their limbs intertwined, until the new school year suddenly reveals how their peers see them. When more than one classmate insists teasingly that they must be a couple, Leo is taken aback. What's so strange about platonic affection between best friends? Anyone who has ever entered the hellmouth of junior high has some sense of what comes next. The insecurities and desperation to fit in, or at least not stand out. The casual cruelties that children are capable of, and the social Darwinism that drives even the happiest kid to act out in ways that feel foreign to themselves. The consequences of Leo's subsequent withdrawal and Remy's wounded bewilderment shouldn't be much more than a glitch, a natural messy byproduct of shifting moods and puberty. Instead, it leads to something devastating, and the movie becomes a visceral, heart-wrecking meditation on the fallout of one momentary choice. A lot of that impact is owed to Dant's impeccable casting. Both of the boys, and particularly Remy's on-screen mother, played by The Missing's Emile Dequin, and his dreamlike visual style, too, which makes ethereal use of his native country's flower fields and slanted light. Close, which took the Grand Prix at Cannes last year, is the 31-year-old director's second feature to win a major prize there, after his 2018 debut Girl, about a trans ballerina, took both the Camera d'Or for Best First Feature and the Independent Queer Palm. Shot in alternating French and Flemish, it's also quintessentially European, but the language of his storytelling is the most universal kind, a moving and often sublime piece of small-scale filmmaking told with uncommon empathy. Leah Greenblatt is rating Close an A-. Cat Person review, Bad Kitty. The acclaimed short story becomes a disjointed romantic thriller that seems to miss the entire point of its source material. This is by Leah Greenblatt. Brevity is the soul of many things, arguably, but it is pretty much non-negotiable in a short story. And so it was that in a few impactful pages, Kristen Rupinian's brutally succinct Cat Person published in The New Yorker in late 2017, managed to become the kind of viral phenomenon mostly confined these days to messy awards show moments or TikTok memes about corn. It's not surprising that a filmmaker would attempt to grab that zeitgeist tiger by the tail, or even painstakingly expand it to reflect the shifting mores and social codes of 2023. What's disappointing is how lost this cat, which premiered last night at the Sundance Film Festival, seems to get along the way. A lean and potent exploration of modern dating padded out into a strenuously self-aware dramedy that flips to half-cocked, wildly improbable thriller in the wholly invented third act. CODA star Emilia Jones is Margot, a 20-year-old sophomore in some ordinary, unspecified college town who spends her days in the paleontology lab and several evenings a week working behind the candy counter at a local movie house. When a diffident giraffe of a man named Robert, played by Succession's Nicholas Braun, comes in one night, she teases him about his order, large popcorn, red vines, and a small, sweet flirtation begins. He's clearly at least a few years out of school, but their text banter zips and zings, and she starts to live for the metallic chime of a new message notification. Real-world romance, though, proves harder to negotiate. In person, their interactions have a fraught edge that belie the easy back and forth of their online personalities. Does Robert like her at all? Does he actually have any cats? Margot debates with her wide-eyed dorm mates and her best friend, a cheerfully strident fourth-wave feminist with, of course, a niche subreddit, played by Hala's breezy, acerbic Geraldine Viswanathan. Nevertheless, she persists for reasons that have as much to do with vanity, anxiety, and the strange square dance of gender roles as they do with physical attraction or the lack of it. And when a sexual encounter at Robert's house reveals the extent of their disconnect, the movie shifts again, sailing quickly past the story's final perfect line with more than half an hour still to burn on screen. It's hard to say how viewers who come to Cat Person without having read the source material will react to the liberties that director Susanna Fogel, who made 2019's enjoyable Daffy, The Spy Who Dumped Me, and screenwriter Michelle Ashford from The Masters of Sex, take with the text. Maybe they'll think it's a just-fine thriller with an inexplicable end, but even the presence of supporting players like Viswanathan, Isabella Rossellini, and a criminally underused Hope Davis can't make sense of too many of the odd choices the movie makes, down to the casting of its leads. As two flawed but essentially adorable people struggling to understand the semaphores of human interaction, Jones and Braun are both relatable in a way that only professionally charismatic actors can be, though it's not clear that Braun particularly should be. The entire intent of the character is flipped by his mere presence in the role and a script that seems either unwilling or unable to allow him any real unlikability beyond one genuinely excruciating sex scene. When he becomes someone else, so does she, necessarily, upending the original story's taught lessons and careful world-building in bizarrely literal ways. By swerving into territory already better owned by outrageous indies like Promising Young Woman, and to a lesser degree last year's Sundance breakout Fresh, Cat forfeits its own underlying message without finding anything else new or even particularly coherent to say. What's left is just another LOL isn't dating crazy, hot take, fattened, and declawed. Leah Greenblatt rates Cat Person a C+. Here's an Eileen review. Anne Hathaway is electric in a wild Hitchcockian noir. Also by Leah Greenblatt, Otessa Mosfay's novel becomes an audacious thriller about female rage and desire, co-starring Jojo Rabbit's Thomasin McKenzie. Some people They're the real people, like in a movie. They're the ones you watch. A man, played by Shea Whigham, tells his grown daughter, that's played by Last Night in Soho's Thomasin McKenzie, with casual cruelty. Other people, they're just filling space. That's you, Eileen. He's a mean drunk and a messy one, an alcoholic ex-cop too gone most days to get out of his bathrobe. But he's not wrong. At 24, Eileen is a mousy shadow, a pale non-entity going through the motions of a life in circa 1964 Massachusetts. Essentially an unpaid handmaiden to her widowed dad, she is benevolently tolerated or simply ignored by pretty much everyone else in their coastal blue-collar town, including her co-workers at the local juvenile prison where she does clerical work, though that doesn't stop her from furiously masturbating to her fantasies about a handsome brooding guard or the couples on Lover's Lane whose steamed-up cars she likes to park behind. Enter Rebecca St. John, played by Anne Hathaway, a blonde goddess in a pencil skirt and the impetus of All That Comes Next in Eileen, a marvelously uneasy thriller soaked in simmering eroticism, Hitchcockian swivels, and wintry New England atmosphere. Readers of the 2015 novel of the same name by Atessa Mosfaith from My Year of Rest and Relaxation know what comes next. The rest might want to put on their seatbelts. Director William Oldroyd's lush mid-century vision will have you thinking of Todd Haynes, but the psychosexual dance here is something else. Carol's sinister sister. Rebecca is the new psychologist at the prison, a Harvard PhD brought in to introduce modern ideas of reform. Eileen is as dazzled and confounded by her movie star presence as everyone else, and shocked when Rebecca makes friendly overtures. How has she been singled out by this exotic creature? Soon they're sharing girlish confidences and going out for cocktails, and Eileen is shedding her sad cardigans for nipped waist dresses, furs, and vampish lipstick. Even in that, though, she's a little bit off. The clothes are her late mother's, glamorous relics of a recent but extinct era. One night, after many drinks, Rebecca even kisses her on the lips. She always seems to have time for Eileen, and they share a fascination with the case of a teenage inmate, played by White Noise's Sam Nivola, who killed his father in his sleep. He's never said why he did it, and his mother, an incandescent mayor in Ireland, won't say a word either. If she can draw him out with her new techniques, Rebecca believes, she can heal him. Working with her husband, Luke Gable, Mosfaith has written a brisk, nourish script, more generally palatable and cinematic than the novel, but still very much in line with the feverish brand of female interiority and body horror she's known for. McKenzie, the young New Zealand actress so good in films like Jojo Rabbit and Leave No Trace, is a naturally sweeter Eileen, though a whole volcano thrums under her obedient, watchful exterior. And Hathaway eats her scenes, finding both the ferociousness and calculation beneath Rebecca's beauty and the wounded humanity. Oldroyd, who also made 2016's pleasingly unhinged Florence Pugh drama Lady Macbeth, is British, but he seems to revel in the Dennis Lehane color of his outer Boston setting, and the great character actors, Whigham, Ireland, Sibowen, Fallon, Hogan, he has at his disposal. For all its heavy themes and the truly wild turn it takes in the third act, it's also a surprisingly funny movie, shot through with visual wit and off-kilter comedy. A lurid triumph, too. By the last frame, Eileen isn't filling space. She's the star, finally, of her own movie. Leah Greenblatt is rating Eileen an A-. Here's something from Entertainment Weekly's quote, kind of magazine that they, as they call it, the awardist. This is how Brian Tyree Henry spent the pandemic with Jennifer Lawrence obsessing over the script of Causeway. There's a quote here from an interview with Joshua Rothkopf, Brian Tyree Henry. The possibility of being more and doing and showing more than what people want to put on you is the most exciting part of my job. The article goes on, a relaxed, unfussy showcase for two of the most sensitive performances of the year, maybe the last several, Causeway feels as rare as a unicorn in today's overheated awardscape. As exciting as it is to see Jennifer Lawrence pare down to the essence of her craft, she plays an Army veteran rebuilding her life in New Orleans after suffering a battlefield catastrophe. It's Atlanta's Brian Tyree Henry, one of Entertainment Weekly's 2022 Entertainers of the Year, who turns in the movie's real revelation as a local mechanic with buried trauma. We spoke with Henry, 40, on the cusp of a new phase, about the most challenging role of his career and why he does what he does. So Entertainment Weekly asks him, you've known the director of Causeway, Lila Nirenberger, for a while, right? And Brian Tyree Henry responds, yeah, we go back almost, it's crazy, 18 years or so. Lila was an undergrad at Yale, and I was a first year at Yale School of Drama. Our rehearsals were pretty much closed. It's an intensive program, so they're closed off to the public. But Lila somehow found her way into the plays. She would be there, and the tenacity of this person was just very cool to see. We would smoke cigarettes and get coffee and sit on the steps of the theater, and I always knew that she was going to go off and become this amazing comet that she is. Her brain is one of the most fascinating, most complex, and most caring places I've ever had the luxury to walk through. Entertainment Weekly asks, does she have a technique or a tactic that she uses? And he responds, I don't want her finding me and taking my kneecaps out about it, but there's this special quality of her that I really care about. I call it the Lila squat, because let's say we're in the middle of our scene and we're doing our thing and cut is called and you're having a conversation with your scene partner and then you turn and Lila is right there, and she wants to discuss. It's something that's very rare. It's truly a gift. I think the reason that she gets that close is because there's an intimacy to her direction. She's right in the thick of it with you. You feel like she's in the trenches with you. She doesn't care about the time. She doesn't care about what the next shot is. She's not going to move until she feels that you have some kind of blood flowing through you that you can go on to do what is asked of you. On paper, Causeway is the kind of project that actors dream of. Two people, scene after scene, coming to an understanding that's not closed. How rare is it getting a script like that? Brian Tyree Henry says, it is very rare. I, at one point, was worried about how I thought viewers wanted to see me. I know that I had made a really good name for myself in the world of comedy, in the world of television. And then, in film, I was used to kind of serving the story by ushering the story along, but not really being the focus. And so when I saw this script with James, there was something that really intrigued me. I think the most intriguing part was his stillness, watching this man walk through the world with the weight of the world on him. There was a quietness to him. Oftentimes, in the quietness and stillness is where the loudness is able to reverberate. And I wanted to experience that because I don't ever want to be pigeonholed. I don't think any actor worth their weight in salt wants that, especially any actor of color. The next question is, do you approach James's guilt and grief from a personal angle? And he says, part of me was really trying to confront a lot of things that I was dealing with myself, the parts that I was angry with, but I also had a true sense of care for him. That was something that was very important. I really cared about him a lot. I really wanted him to be okay in the simplest ways of just dropping the load just a bit, being able to walk with his head up. Just a little bit. Somewhat unrelated, but I know a lot of people enjoyed your performance in Bullet Train as a thoughtful assassin. Is there a through line here for you in terms of how you choose your roles? Do you have a philosophy to it? I don't. I'm going to sound like a hippie, no diss to hippies, but I let these characters tell me. I let whatever these black men have to say tell me. I've been told most of my life how to be, how to show myself, how not to be, especially more often than not, how not to be. And I feel like